Russian Roulette, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A reporter takes a long look at Russia's involvement in the 2016 presidential election. His conclusion?
Brazen, clandestine information warfare against the United States to try to subvert American democracy.
Also, Netflix admits they're underpaying their queen on The Crown.
To discover that the star of the show is being paid a lot less than someone who isn't in it as much as her, isn't as interesting, isn't as key to the whole production, is amazing.
Plus, how Stephen Hawking's daughter once described her father.
He's a bit of an impresario at heart, and he loves a big show, a big stage.
No wonder the universe was Hawking's playground. That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us. For the past year, President Trump has clearly been reluctant to stand up to Russia on a number of issues. But today, a close ally may have shown him how it's done. I'm talking about British Prime Minister Theresa May, who went before Parliament, took off the glove, so to speak, and took a swing at the Kremlin.
Under the Vienna Convention, the United Kingdom will now expel 23 Russian diplomats who have been identified as undeclared intelligence officers. They have just 1 week to leave.
This all has to do with the poisoning and what the UK says was the attempted murder of former Russian intelligence officer Sergei Skripal with a nerve agent last week. This will be the largest mass expulsion of Russian diplomats since 1986. Russia's official response has been to deny all the accusations. A spokesman for President Vladimir Putin said that Moscow won't accept absolutely unfounded allegations. But you don't need to wait to hear from Putin himself. Just tune into the Kremlin-funded TV channel RT, formerly known as Russia Today. Our London reporter Leo Hornack has been, just to see how RT/the Kremlin is digesting the Skripal affair. First of all, Leo, what is RT? And in London, can you watch it on cable or you have to stream it online?
You can stream it online. You can watch it on cable. I mean, RT is a strange beast as a TV channel. It has a specific UK feed where if you watch it in this country, you get a newscaster with a British accent reading out the headlines. And in many ways, it looks very similar to the other news channels, to the BBC news channel, to CNN. There's the graphics, the swooping sounds, the dramatic music. But it doesn't claim to be the same as those channels, and it isn't. I've been watching it pretty heavily the last 24 hours. I've been in a kind of RT UK bath. And yeah, it's a different experience. Their slogan is question more. And the premise of a lot of the coverage is not that we can disprove what the rest of the media is saying. We are just not certain that any of it has any basis in reality. In other words, we're not impartial either, but no one is. So what is truth? It seems to be the kind of underlying premise of a lot of the coverage that you see on RT.
So RT broadcasts in English, but is it basically the voice of the Kremlin because it's funded by the Kremlin?
They would deny that. And a lot of their coverage is not clearly connected to Russia at all. You know, you get stories about poverty in Britain, things which are generally critical of the UK government, but they're not relentlessly about how great Vladimir Putin is. Where things begin to change is in the sort of story we've had this week.
All right, well, let's get into that. How heavily is the Skripal poisoning featuring in their coverage right now? What are you seeing?
Unsurprisingly, this whole new Cold War between the West and Britain in particular and the Kremlin is right up there. And as I was saying, it's a lot more subtle than in some ways you might think if you think of sort of cliched propaganda. What they have is they lead in with Russia denying, and then they will have guests, and almost all their guests are taking the side of the Kremlin, hinting at conspiracy. I think we've got a few clips. These are from news programs, interviews, discussions from the last 24 hours.
Moscow says it had nothing to do with the poisoning of a former Russian spy in Salisbury. In London, an emergency Cobra meeting is...
It appears, and highly likely, these are the words used by UK Prime Minister Theresa May, pinning blame on Russia for the poison attack on a former...
Long before any conclusions are drawn, Russia is being vilified. The dots have been connected in the eyes of the world press.
Yeah, walking that fine line between propaganda and kind of objective journalism. Let's get behind the story here. That's what I'm hearing there.
Exactly. And one thing that perhaps that doesn't come across in those clips is RT is a very sarcastic channel. I mean, for example, there was a whole sort of montage yesterday evening about how this story was being treated. And instead of talking maybe about, you know, the substance of the allegations or doing a sort of dig into that, they just had sort of comedy jazz kind of music is the best description I can give. And then the words appearing on the screen, blame Russia, a guidebook to Kiev vocabulary, and then going number one, highly likely, and clips of British politicians saying it is highly likely that Russia is responsible. And then going through all the euphemisms and emphasizing the fact that British politicians aren't able to say yet with certainty that Russia, that the Kremlin is behind this attack.
Our reporter in London at the BBC, Leo Hornack. Leo, you may now return to your regularly scheduled programs.
Thanks very much, Marco.
Guests on RT may argue that the Russian government had nothing to do with the Skripal poisoning, but my next guest sees a link between the attack on the former spy and the hacking of the 2016 U.S. presidential election.
I think they're both part of this bold, Putin-driven campaign against the West.
That's investigative reporter David Korn. He's the author, along with Michael Isikoff, of the new book, Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. Korn says the Obama White House could have done more to deter the Russian cyber attacks in the months before the 2016 vote.
By the end of July, the U.S. intelligence community had really gathered good intelligence, convincing them that Russia was behind this, that they were behind the hacking and they were involved with the dissemination of the material. And the question became what to do. Throughout the month of August and September, these high-level officers of the U.S. government, of Obama's administration, met. And while they were meeting, they also learned that Russian hackers had started penetrating and probing and scanning state election systems. And they became very fearful that Russia might have a plan to blow up the election on Election Day, maybe by, not necessarily by changing results, but maybe by blocking registration databases or changing information on databases so when people showed up to vote, they wouldn't be registered.
So why didn't they do something about it?
Well, there was the possibility that if they made too big a deal out of this, it would serve the purposes that Russia was aiming to do and disrupt the election. If they said things that caused Americans to lose faith in the election, then they were doing the Russians' work themselves. Mm. They also realized that, you know, Donald Trump was out there saying the elections are going to be rigged. And so if they said anything that made people believe that they might be rigged, Trump would use that against them and maybe try to blow up the election himself because he, at that point, believed he was going to lose. Now, there were members of the National Security Council staff within the White House who drew up a series of plans for very severe cyber counterattacks. And this included attacking Russian news sites, Russian sites involved with the hacked material, putting out information that the intelligence community had on Putin and his inner circle, including on maybe bank records of Putin's daughters. Mm. They were in Latvian banks.
How close were those plans to getting weaponized?
Well, what happened was Susan Rice, the national security advisor, told the people doing that planning to stand down because Obama was not prepared to take those steps, in part because he was told by James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, and others that if he got into a cyber war, a tit-for-tat war with Russia, that the United States, which is far more wired and has a greater and more significant cyber infrastructure, would be at a disadvantage. James Clapper told the president in one of these meetings that if this happened, the Russians conceivably could shut down the electric grid of the United States. Wow. Now, this raises a big question, right? Why is our grid so vulnerable? Why are we vulnerable so that he could not respond and have confidence that the United States could get the better of that situation? There was also the presumption on the Russian side, on the American side, everywhere, that Hillary Clinton was going to win and that the influence campaign, by that I mean stealing the emails, first from the DNC and then later from John Podesta, the campaign chairman for Hillary Clinton, would not change the election.
So despite this Putin campaign on the West, Trump still mostly seems to defer to Putin. And with this news today from London that Prime Minister Theresa May is going to eject 23 Russian diplomats, does that make President Trump look weaker on Russia? She's taking the lead in punishing them.
Of course it does. After the election, Obama put sanctions on Russia. He booted out 35 diplomats, who many of whom were spies. He closed down two facilities that the Russians had in the United States that were used for intelligence operations. Immediately upon taking office, Trump gives the word from the White House to the State Department, what can we do to ease these sanctions, or if not, lift them? And people at the State Department who worked on the sanctions are enraged, and they go running to Congress in a way that they're not supposed to and say, you have to stop this. You have to stop the White House from easing up on the sanctions that we just imposed. And in fact, Congress, in a bipartisan bill that was almost unanimous, passes new sanctions on Russia, but the sanctions have to be implemented by the White House, by the executive branch. And later in the year, in 2017, as they are supposed to kick in, the White House and the executive branch that Trump oversees doesn't take the steps mandated by the legislation. So Trump has done the opposite. He has tried to avoid putting sanctions on Russia for its own attack. And this was information warfare. This was an attack on the United States. And the other day, when the White House denounced this attempted murder in England, they refused to use the word Russia. It just said it was terrible, this thing happened. And then when Rex Tillerson, on his own, said that it was clear that Russia was involved, coincidence or not, he was fired the next day. So, you know, there is nothing that Trump has done as a candidate or as president that would cause even the greatest conspiracy theorist to rethink their assumptions about his attitudes towards Russia and Putin. It's quite striking.
David, if you wouldn't mind, just bring us up to speed on the Mueller investigation, because in the last few days, it feels like there are some clearer narratives that are starting to emerge. Where are things at?
Well, he's looking at the Russian side. You know, he indicted 13 Russian nationals who were involved in the social media campaign, the clandestine social media campaign that was part of Putin's attack on the election. He is going after people who lie and turning them. So I'm like every other reporter who's following this. You know, we're looking through a glass that's kind of fogged up with our own breath to try to see what Mueller's doing. There are very few leaks coming out of there. You know, we can read a few tea leaves and we can read the indictments that are coming. You know, it's one of my least favorite cliches, but I think it's appropriate here. I think we see the tip of the iceberg. We don't know everything he's examining, but we do know he's taking this very seriously.
David Korn there, co-author of Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. Before the break, I want to tell you about a powerful piece of reporting you'll hear on tomorrow's show. It begins with a tragedy. Gene Jimenez died in an immigration detention center. Then this prison tape came out with Gene telling his stepfather that he was tired of his life.
The night of his death, a guard had seen him jumping rope with a sheet that he eventually used to hang himself and did nothing about it.
Reporter Robin Yurovich learned how a private prison used by ICE missed warning signs of an inmate suicide and how government outsourcing of immigrant detention encourages a hands-off attitude. That story tomorrow. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. It's the world. You've probably heard by now, British physicist Stephen Hawking has died at the age of 76. His insights shaped modern cosmology and inspired curious audiences around the world in the millions. For most of his life, Hawking suffered from Lou Gehrig's disease, which affected his ability to move and speak. That's why he used a speech synthesizer to communicate. My BBC colleague Rebecca Morell has us look back at Hawking's life and work.
Hello. My name is Stephen Hawking.
The instantly recognizable voice of the cosmologist who became a cultural icon. Stephen Hawking brought physics to the mainstream.
I think my achievement has been to help to show that time as we know it has a beginning in the Big Bang and an end in black holes.
And he was an inspiration to many for accomplishing all of this despite a debilitating disease.
Theoretical physics is one of the few fields in which being disabled is no handicap.
It was at university that Stephen Hawking's talent for science began to shine through. He found physics ridiculously easy. Stephen's mother, Isabel, spoke to the BBC in 2002.
I think Stephen was a very normal young man. He liked parties. He liked pretty girls, only pretty ones. He liked adventure. And he did, to some extent, like work.
But there were already signs that something wasn't right. And while studying for his PhD at Cambridge University, he was diagnosed with a form of motor neurone disease, a degenerative condition that causes progressive weakness and muscle wastage. The Astronomer Royal Martin Rees was a postgraduate student with Stephen.
I remember this young man already walking with difficulty, who was embarked on his thesis and was told that he may not live to finish his PhD.
But he defied this prognosis and went on to make his biggest theoretical breakthroughs.
I suppose his greatest single achievement, the one he said he wanted to have inscribed on his gravestone, was an equation which linked together three previously unconnected areas of physics. It linked together the nature of gravity, the quantum principle, and thermodynamics. And this is a so-called Hawking radiation.
So Stephen will basically be talking about infinity.
As Professor Hawking's condition progressed, his speech became increasingly slurred. And after a bout of pneumonia that nearly killed him, he lost his capacity to speak entirely. He had to use a speech synthesizer, which created the voice that became his trademark.
People describe its accent as American, but the Americans say it is Scandinavian or Irish. Anyway, whatever it is, everyone can understand it.
Around this time too, Professor Hawking turned to writing. The most successful of his mainstream books was A Brief History of Time, published in 1988. Kitty Ferguson is his biographer.
The underlying motive for writing that book was to make science and his work understandable to what he calls ordinary people, like you and I.
At home, though, Professor Hawking's life was turbulent. He divorced his first wife and went on to marry one of his nurses. He described this marriage as passionate and tempestuous. There were even allegations that his second wife physically abused him, although he always denied this.
Cambridgeshire police are investigating allegations of an assault on Stephen Hawking, the disabled scientist and author of the best-selling book, A Brief History of Time.
Despite his private life occasionally appearing in the media, Professor Hawking generally liked fame. He toured the world, was invited onto chat shows, and in 2014 was portrayed by Eddie Redmayne in a film about his life. He even appeared on The Simpsons.
Stephen Hawking!
The world's smartest man!
What are you doing here?
His daughter Lucy spoke about her father's love of the limelight in 2012.
Another facet of my father that people don't very rarely highlight is what a showman he is. He's a bit of an impresario at heart, and he loves a big show, a big stage.
Underneath it all, though, Martin Rees found his friend's ordinariness extraordinary.
What was amazing all through his life was the way, despite his immense handicaps, he remained so psychologically normal, not only in being able to continue with his science, but also in his interest in current affairs, his willingness to express robust opinions, and his enjoyment in activities quite away from his science.
Stephen Hawking will be remembered for turning almost unimaginable adversity into something he described at times as an advantage. And it was this attitude that made him an inspiration for so many.
Very true. The BBC's Rebecca Morell reporting there. Let me ask you a question. How much do you think Queen Elizabeth II is worth? How does about $530 million sound? And just a few days ago, it was revealed that she's even got a side hustle. She's made more than $9 million off of horse racing over the past three decades. Pretty decent for a hobby. Okay, now a quick note on what Netflix thinks playing the Queen is worth. The online streaming service produces The Crown, a drama about Queen Elizabeth II's life. Claire Foy plays the monarch and does so really, really well. She's got a Golden Globe to prove it, too. In the drama, Matt Smith, who once starred as Doctor Who, plays her husband, Prince Philip. And what do you know? Netflix has now publicly admitted that Smith gets paid more than Foy. Not good, especially considering the recent post-Me Too push to end the gender pay gap in Hollywood and elsewhere. My BBC colleague, entertainment reporter Emma Bullimore, has been following the news about The Crown's pay gap.
Well, this has actually come from Netflix themselves. It's quite, you know, it's a startling revelation, really. I don't know if it's that they wanted to say it before it was going to be exposed, or, you know, whether there's been journalists sniffing around. But this is shocking. I mean, I think people think that Netflix is young and cool and they understand these things and they wouldn't get involved in this kind of gender pay gap. So to discover that the star of the show is being paid a lot less than someone who isn't in it as much as her, isn't as interesting, isn't as key to the whole production, is amazing. And I just think people think we're beyond that now. You know, they might think that contracts that started 20 years ago or stars from a different age might be used to this, but it's shocking that it's still happening. And I think they said, you know, it's a difficult thing when you're casting celebrities because of this thing, star power. So they said Matt Smith had this Doctor Who fame. He was bringing people to the show in a way that Claire Foy wouldn't, which, you know, to be honest, I think is a load of rubbish because she is a very well-respected actress. People were very excited to see her in the role. So they say that's why there's this kind of disparity, but it won't happen in the future. It just sounds like they're squirming out of something that they know is wrong. We're having such a moment right now about Time's Up, about gender pay gap, and it's just not acceptable. This was the most expensive show that has ever been made, you know, certainly one of them. The budget was colossal. So out of that budget, you can't afford to pay the star, the person holding it all together, the person that's getting the awards nods. You can't afford to pay them properly. It's just outrageous.
That was BBC Entertainment reporter Emma Bullimore. Season 3 of The Crown, coming out later this year, has two new actors playing Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip because, you know, royals do age. I'm sure we'll hear whether Netflix has learned its lesson in Season 3 when it comes to pay equality or not. I'm Marco Werman. Last month, several Russians were killed during a U.S.-led operation in Syria, and people have questions.
You know, how many died, and did the Russian government, or the U.S. for that matter, know these Russians were there? And also just, you know, what were they even doing there?
The answers may lie with a security outfit that some call the Russian Blackwater. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Back to Russia now. Yeah, it seems like we say that a lot lately, doesn't it? Earlier we told you about the rising tensions between Russia and Britain. Now I want to switch our focus to what drives Russia these days, its ambition to once again become a global power with influence well beyond its borders. We're taking a week-long look at that with The World's Charles Maynes, and today we're talking about the war in Syria. Russia's military campaign there has taken aim at the Islamic State while supporting the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. And to understand that campaign, Charles wanted to take a closer look at a battle that happened last month.
So this incident I want to talk about happened the night of February 7th, to be exact. The U.S. military and its coalition partners in Syria, they came under attack. And the reports both from Syrian and U.S. officials describe the U.S. then carrying out airstrikes against the group of pro-Assad forces. Their numbers are put around 300 to 500 people in Deir al-Zor. This is an oil-rich area of eastern Syria. And the results were lethal. So for these enemy fighters, they were caught up in this U.S. counterattack. But here's the thing. Among those killed that evening were reportedly scores of Russian nationals, or certainly some. We still don't have an exact figure because the numbers are still disputed.
I mean, that headline is pretty stunning. Russians and Americans, citizens from two nuclear powers fighting and killing each other. I mean, that's pretty serious stuff. What are the theories of what exactly happened?
Yeah, привет. Вот то, что новости показывают, да, там по телевизору, что там, ну, в Сирии там 25 человек там раненых.
Right, so there were these early reports, including this phone message we're hearing now. It was being passed around online, and it's, just to be clear, it's very sort of graphic Russian language descriptions of counting of these Russian losses. And they say that as many as 200 men were killed and scores injured at the hands of these U.S. airstrikes, and they name the U.S. as carrying this out. Now, I've spoken to a Russian source who, although not involved in this incident, fought in Syria and fought among several of these mercenaries. He ID'd to me one of the known Russians killed. This is a nationalist named Kirill Ananev. This source also claimed that these casualty numbers that were being cited, around 200 men killed, were basically accurate. But, you know, let me again stress that we don't know that's true.
Right.
So what we do know is that families and friends of several of those killed on February 7th in Syria, they've gone public.
Буквально проходит минута, он мне перезванивает и говорит, что
Now, for example, this is some tape from Znak. It's a web publication in the Ural Mountains. They're interviewing one woman who describes getting a call from someone informing her that her husband and one of her husband's friends were both killed in this incident.
И все, он говорит, вам должны официально позвонить с Ростова, сказать, что на самом деле это все.
Now, what we do know is that the number at this point, it's 10 Russian mercenaries and counting from this February incident that were killed. But this, of course, ignores reports of dozens of other mercenaries who've been killed in earlier battles in Syria. And those, of course, did not involve American troops.
What is the Russian government saying about all this, Charles?
You know, their answers have shifted somewhat. At first, the Kremlin said they just had no knowledge of Russians or Russian mercenaries fighting in Syria, of course, aside from their official military campaign. Then eventually, the foreign ministry came out with a statement that changed the story a bit. You know, they acknowledged that some Russians had died under sort of mysterious circumstances and said these were apparently Russian nationals. But the numbers were way, way lower than the media reports. So let's listen to a reaction from Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman. This is Maria Zakharova.
Материалы о гибели десятков и сотен российских граждан – это классическая дезинформация.
So she called the reports of huge losses a classic disinformation campaign and suggested this was done by the U.S., by Western media, that Russia had some info that 5 people were killed, but not 10, not 20, not 200. And she stressed that the Russian military were not harmed in any way, and that they were looking into this. Now, I should say that there's a German publication, this is Der Spiegel, that also published a story that cast doubt on these huge numbers of losses as well. They put that number around 20 killed and said others were from other countries. But, you know, if we stay focused on Russia, at the very least, what we have here is this just huge chasm in versions of what happened out there in the desert on February 7th in Syria. You know, how many died, and did the Russian government, or the U.S. for that matter, know these Russians were there? And also just, you know, what were they even doing there? So, you know, it's a story that many Russians are intensely interested in.
Yeah, I mean, there are a ton of questions here, Charles. And I mean, just to start with, who are these Russians fighting in Syria outside the usual military command structure?
You know, actually, we have a pretty good idea of that. And that's not only because of this incident with the U.S., but because we've known about Russian mercenaries operating in Syria for some time. They're part of a private security firm called the Wagner Group.
Wagner, like Wagner the composer.
Exactly. You know, but think of Wagner Group as a sort of kind of Russian Blackwater. You know, Blackwater, of course, being the controversial American private security firm the U.S. employed in significant numbers in Iraq. You know, and although there's not a lot of information, Russian independent media have been sketching the outlines of the Wagner Group story for over the past year or so. So, you know, I took a train over to St. Petersburg. It's a nice ride if you haven't done it. And I went there to meet the Russian journalist who broke the story.
Денис Коротков, корреспондент Петербургской интернет-газеты «Фонтанка».
This is a guy named Денис Коротков. Коротков is a reporter with «Фонтанка», a local independent news website in St. Petersburg that's known to have sources with the Russian security services. And we met for coffee at a sushi restaurant.
Yeah, of course you did. You meet for coffee in Russia at a sushi bar. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I thought so too. Anyway, so of course I asked him, first off, you know, what proof does he have about this Wagner Group? I mean, something that's so, so shadowy.
Документов, которые я мог бы предъявить, например, в суде, у меня нет, да?
Do I have documents that would hold up in court? No. But I have documents that show that this group exists, that several thousand people participated in it, and that they participated in the war, and that some of them even received military honors for their efforts. And we have documents that show who was the organizer and who financed this group. So I think we've proved this. Is that enough? Let our readers judge. But for me, it's convincing.
He also suggested that he knows who's behind these private security contractors, Wagner. What is his theory?
Well, you know, the main guy, allegedly, is someone we've heard a lot about in the news recently. This is a businessman and restaurateur named Yevgeny Prigozhin, also known as Putin's chef. So he, as the nickname might imply, is rumored to be close to the Russian president. Putin once celebrated his birthday at Prigozhin's restaurant in St. Petersburg. Now, some may recognize Prigozhin's name because he's also rumored to be involved in not only the Wagner Group, but also trolling, that he's the financier behind the, you know, this internet research agency we've heard so much, this
right.
famous St. Petersburg troll farm, for which he's on U.S. sanctions list. And, of course, that's another issue altogether.
And Prigozhin, Putin's chef, is he saying anything about Wagner?
No. Prigozhin is a pretty shadowy figure. He denies he has anything to do with the Wagner Group, frankly, just as he does with the Internet Research Agency. But here's the thing.
В Георгиевском зале, зале русской, российской ратной славы, в которую и вы вписали теперь...
So back in December 2016, Putin held a ceremony to congratulate Russians who'd served in Syria. You know, his big sort of state honors.
Ордена Святого Георгия Победоносца, утвержденного Екатериной II.
And so the reporter for Russian state television is doing her stand-up, and you know, as this ceremony is going on, people are in the background sitting at tables. But if you stop the frame, you see this bald guy, a Russian colonel named Dmitry Utkin, in the background. Now, Utkin is another shadowy figure. There are a lot of media reports about him, although he never makes public statements. But according to these reports, he works for... Well, let me try a different way, Marco. Just guess his favorite composer.
Wagner?
Wagner. In fact, Utkin is Wagner. It's his nom de guerre. So we have this situation where we have Prigozhin as the financier of the Wagner Group, and Utkin is the head of military operations. Now, you know, was his presence in front of cameras on state TV, was that a slip-up? Did nobody care? You know, who knows? But it's yet more proof that the Wagner Group is tied to the Kremlin.
So let's just get back to the soldiers who work for them or the private contractors. What other evidence is there that these mercenaries are operating in Syria? Is there any?
Yes. And, you know, let me bring in another important Russian source in this Wagner story.
Меня зовут Руслан Левиев. Я руковожу командой Conflict Intelligence Team. Мы занимаемся расследованием военных конфликтов.
So this is Ruslan Leveyev. He's of the Conflict Intelligence Team. This is a team of Russian researchers that started doing digital forensics work in Ukraine, but has also tracked Russia's war in Syria.
Ну и мы все мы прекрасно помним вот эти вот ляпы со скриншотами из игры, которые якобы доказывают.
So he's uncovered all sorts of fakery surrounding the Russian campaign in Syria. For example, he caught Russia's defense ministry trying to pass off grainy images from a video game as real images from the Syrian war. You know, and the conflict intelligence team has also tracked through social media and online reports details of Russian losses in Syria. And it points to them being much higher than official figures. And most of these losses were incurred by the Wagner Group mercenaries, an estimated 80 Russians killed in the field of battle, and Leveyev says dozens more who died from injuries later in hospital. So, you know, this conflict intelligence team, they've also ID'd Wagner employees who have otherwise gone missing in Syria. And a prominent case involves the fate of Roman Zabalotny and Grigory Tsurkanu. These are two Russians who were captured in Syria. This is tape released online of their interrogation.
Rus? Ruskin? Rus?
There are also Wagner employees whose whereabouts are still unknown, although the attention brought to the case by CIT, by this conflict intelligence team, have forced the Russian government to at least acknowledge these men are missing, though they won't say what they were doing in Syria.
You know, I can hear some people saying, oh, Russia, they've got mercenaries, so what? Those guys signed up for it, and the United States, after all, had Blackwater.
It's true, and while people can and do still argue over how ethical Blackwater was in Iraq, you know, Blackwater at least was a real organization. You know, it exists. It has real contracts with the government, and it's acknowledged that way. And that's not the case here. Now, let's just listen to one more bit from Ruslan Leveyev from the conflict intelligence team on this.
Официально группа Вагнера не существует в России. Никто ее официально не признает.
There is no Wagner. Officially, no one acknowledges them. And when families try to find out what happened to their sons from the military, the generals say, we also don't know anything. They say, it's not a question for us. So when people say, my son went to Syria and disappeared, they're hostages to this situation. Because these people, they're basically told their sons are expendable. They are cannon fodder.
I mean, a lot of this does remind me of Russia's role in Ukraine and those little green men. We just heard yesterday your story about the Russian military blending in as volunteers in Ukraine.
Yeah, in a way. But the irony here is that it's a switch. The tactic is completely inverted. So if in Ukraine the Russian army officially is not there, Russia says it's a civil war while tacitly endorsing and acknowledging the presence of Russian volunteers. In Syria, the Russian army is there. It's an official military operation endorsed by the Kremlin, but they don't acknowledge these volunteers, these mercenaries. So it's all backwards.
Yeah, why go this way? I mean, Russia's already officially fighting in Syria.
I think you have to go back to the motives for the war. You know, technically Putin went into Syria saying this was a war against terrorism, against ISIS. But, you know, there were always these other factors involved. I mean, one, Russia was looking to end its isolation and try and force the international community to engage with it after being sort of ostracized over the Crimea issue. They were also there to protect their military foothold in the Middle East. You know, they were rescuing an ally in need in Bashar al-Assad. But, you know, when I talked to Ruslan Liveyev, this is the conflict intelligence team guy, you know, he just points out that all of this only makes sense if the optics of the war in Syria look good. And, you know, that means keeping Russian losses low.
So, Charles, I'm guessing there are big political implications here as well.
Yeah, the timing here is also really important. Now, if you go back to December, Putin paid a surprise visit to the Russian air base in Syria.
Здравствуйте, товарищи!
And it was kind of this mission accomplished moment. He announced a mass withdrawal of Russia's official military presence. He said the, you know, troops had successfully defeated ISIS and that the soldiers were going to go home as heroes. You know, and all this was happening against the backdrop of the Russian presidential elections,
which are coming up soon,
very soon, March 18th. And, you know, and there's also this falling public support for the war. You know, and we've seen really Russia go out of its way to play up the heroism and sacrifices of soldiers who were killed in battle when it did occur. You know, just take this case recently. There was Roman Filipov. He's a Russian pilot whose plane was shot down over Syria. And he ended up being surrounded by enemy fighters linked to Al-Qaeda. This happened just last month as well. And rather than being captured, he reportedly blew himself up with a grenade and took out several enemy fighters with him. So the Russian government has given Filipov the highest state honors. They've pushed him, perhaps rightly so, as this total war hero. The delivery of his casket and his funeral, that was all covered on national television, with top defense ministry officials there to salute him. You know, but you have to wonder how this looks to families of the mercenaries, you know, most of them who think, again, maybe rightly so, that Wagner is an extension of the Russian defense ministry and that they, you know, in their own way, okay, they were being paid money, but they were part of this bigger Russian mission in Syria. And, you know, these men aren't afforded that hero's goodbye, and you get the impression that they certainly aren't likely to get it.
Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks very much for your reporting on this.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, Charles will be back with more on that infamous troll farm in St. Petersburg. With Secretary of State Rex Tillerson out and CIA head Mike Pompeo ready to take his place, Gina Haspel is poised to be the first female director of the CIA, that is, if she passes Senate confirmation. Trump already made her the first female deputy director of the CIA last year, and then, as now, she provokes some strong opinions. Greg Miller is a national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Unlike her predecessor, Greg, Gina Haspel has a ton of experience in the CIA, 30 years, including leadership roles. She's earned friends. She's also earned some enemies. Can you just talk about how she's viewed by all sides?
Right. I mean, she's a career person, the first career person in quite a long time to ascend directly into the directorship if she's confirmed. That hasn't happened in many, many years. John Brennan, who was the CIA director under Obama, had spent much of his career at the agency, but he was coming from the White House when he took that top job. Gina has never really left the agency. She's been there that entire time, and she has a really high level of support among the workforce there. That said, her very deep connections to the agency's use of so-called enhanced interrogations or torture in the aftermath of the September 11 attacks are really problematic for human rights groups, for many members of Congress. The fact that she is even getting this nomination now, however, I think suggests that the sort of intensity of that opposition has waned, and that's happening for a couple reasons.
Yeah, what are those reasons?
Well, one of them is, I think, that partly time has passed, and so that issue has faded into the background. Not for everybody, but for some. The other is, though, the sort of political reality of this administration, where there have been other names that have been floated to be potential CIA directors in the Trump administration who were really hardline, right-wing sort of political types, including Senator Tom Cotton. And so I think even many Democrats on the Hill would rather see a career person like Gina Haspel in that CIA job than somebody like Tom Cotton.
So Haspel already plays an important role in the agency as its deputy director. How would her bump up to the top change her day-to-day activities and the operation of the whole agency?
I think one thing it will mean for her is a lot more time at the White House, a lot more interaction with the president.
Well, Trump said yesterday, the quote was, she is an outstanding person who also I have gotten to know very well, but she's not Mike Pompeo, who's seen as a real Trump loyalist. Do you think Haspel will maintain the distance needed to keep the CIA independent without herself getting fired?
I think that accounts to a large measure for the support that she's gotten from current and former agency people following this nomination. I mean, former directors lined up to praise her yesterday, and I think that's largely because they believe she will be better at that than Pompeo has been.
What are the chances she'll get blocked in the Senate? Because we know John McCain, who opposes torture, has been critical of Haspel's nomination. Are there enough GOPs like him to block her nomination?
I don't think so, unless something new surfaces. I don't think there's much GOP opposition. I think she will face tough questions. Senator McCain, of course, among those who is most concerned about her connections to the agency's interrogation program. But, of course, he's not on the Senate Intelligence Committee, which handles her nomination. Mm. There are definitely Democrats who stepped forward yesterday and said they're going to oppose her nomination. But even Senator Feinstein, who led the Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation of the CIA interrogation program, issued a sort of non-committal statement yesterday suggesting that she's willing to listen or hear out Haspel as a candidate, not oppose her from the outset.
Greg Miller is a national security correspondent with The Washington Post. Thanks very much for your time, Greg.
Sure, thanks.
Let's hear now from someone who was there when Gina Haspel was involved with CIA dark sites and so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, which a lot of people have called torture. John Radzin served as CIA Assistant General Counsel from 2002 to 2004. He now teaches at the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. I asked him to clarify Haspel's role back then.
Marco, I can't rely on my work to tell you what she did. I'll rely on the public record. From the public record, it seems that she had a senior role in one of these secret sites. The reporting says that she was involved in the supervision of some of these enhanced interrogations, these harsh interrogations. She also, during that time period, would have played a role in some of the renditions, the transfers of terrorism suspects from points outside the United States to other points, to other countries.
So the secret site I've read was in Thailand. Do we know how many suspects she was involved in terms of interrogation?
When we talk about their interrogation, and one site is mentioned, there were two interrogations that were done. The use of the waterboard has been reported in many areas. One of the suspects was subjected to the waterboard 83 times. Another suspect, according to the public reports, was subjected to the waterboard 3 times.
Yeah, so 83 times waterboarded. That suspect was Abu Zubaydah. Was what happened to him in that enhanced interrogation, in those sessions, was it deemed legal at the time, or did it go beyond what was allowed in an interrogation?
Those sessions seem to have fallen within the parameters at the time. There were some other interrogation tactics. This has come out in the Inspector General report from the CIA that went beyond it. But what should be clear about the main part of this program is that this was presidentially approved. This had President Bush's approval, the vice president's approval, Director Tenet's approval. So whatever Gina Haspel was doing, she was doing in line with all these approvals. This was not something that Gina Haspel was doing on her own. This was not some rogue operation.
So one thing that there's been a lot of reporting on is destruction of tapes of interrogations that apparently Haspel oversaw. How problematic do you see that?
Of all the things that have been mentioned about her nomination, that's probably the most troubling to me. I'm not saying that this necessarily disqualifies her, but it's something that goes counter to the chain of command and perhaps the rule of law. What happened is that those tapes were ordered destroyed. That was from headquarters. The reporting is that Gina Haspel had some role in that. As I followed it, I was out of the CIA at that time. It seems that those orders went contrary to the instructions from the chief lawyer at the CIA, the general counsel, John Rizzo, or the acting general counsel. Paspal has not been reprimanded since then. There was a criminal investigation. There was an inspector general investigation about this. She was not reprimanded in any of those areas. But I think this decision, and maybe she's going to say that she was following orders on that, that decision seems to go counter to the kind of checks that we have in the CIA, the lawyers, the inspector general office, that is making sure that the operations are consistent with the ability to do oversight in Congress or the ability to check these activities in courts or other places. So I imagine that that will be another area where many questions will be asked to Gina Haspel.
And we all know how well the "I was just following orders" defense goes.
It doesn't go that well at times.
Clearly, a lot to process as Gina Haspel heads into her confirmation hearings for head of Central Intelligence. We'll leave it there today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.